Well, what we'd like to talk about are the Cascades, volcanoes, and since the Cascades, especially the magnificent edifices in the Cascades are these big volcanoes, and we'll talk about the volcanoes. And then at the end of this, then we'll, as I've been trying to do all week, we'll start out with a bigger picture and we'll sort of come back at the end to Holden, what it means for Holden. And I forgot, I put in there a geologic time bomb. So we'll talk about the geologic time bomb. The bad news is it is a geologic time bomb. The good news is there'll be plenty of alarm bells before the alarm goes up, before it finally goes off. Because these things don't erupt without warning. Even the big eruptions don't do that. Okay, so you might remember, but we'll go through it for people who haven't been able to get out of school in any time to visit. That these are seismic events, these are earthquake events, plotted on the world map. And when we talked about plate tectonics, we saw that those line up along what we now know are boundaries between crustal tectonic plates on the Earth's surface. And so most of the tectonic activity, earthquakes, volcanoes, lots of the other activity on the Earth's surface is related to those plate boundaries, and quite a lot of it is concentrated right along the plate boundaries. I mentioned the other day that Haiti sits right on one of those plate boundaries and had a catastrophic earthquake not too long ago. And then just before I came, I guess, just last week, Christchurch, New Zealand had a large magnitude earthquake, but this one in Indonesia, of course, caused the tsunami a few years ago. But the Earth's crust, these plates are moving past each other, and so they cause earthquakes as they do that.
And the one in Chile about 6 months ago was
yeah, right there on that subduction zone. That's right. We'll get to that in a second. Well, we'll get to subduction zones, not to the earthquake in Chile, because that's a little bit beyond what we're going to talk about today. But you'll also remember from an earlier session this week that we said that Western Washington is sort of a collage of flotsam and jetsam on this side of the Strait Creek, Fraser Lake fault zone. These are continental fragments, and that's what we're on here in the Chelan Mountains. There's Stehekin, so we're about down here where the T is, or so close to that, at Holden. But these are continental fragments of various sorts, and with a few marine pieces added in. But these are generally continental crustal fragments that have been assembled. Some of them assembled before they arrived to North America, and some of them arrived by themselves and were accreted or included then in North America. Outboard or west of the Strait Creek, Fraser River Strait Creek fault zone, this collage is all oceanic material, so oceanic crust. Lava flows that came out on the bottom of the ocean. And in the San Juan Islands, it's lots of places around here, it's real easy to demonstrate that because these Pella lava, some of you may have seen movies or pictures of these, when they come out, when lava flows come out underneath the ocean, they actually form these pillows before they. And so those are abundant in this terrain here. So it's upon this terrain in Northwest Washington that the modern Cascades are built. And they have been going for some time. And they are related to the subduction or sort of overriding of the oceanic plate called the Gorda Plate, the Juan de Fuca Plate, the Explorer Plate. Those are all parts of the Pacific. But this spreading center right here called the Juan de Fuca Ridge, remember we said that there were mountain chains on the bottom of the ocean, and they are spreading apart, and new oceanic crust is being created along those spreading centers, here, here, and here. And so the Pacific Plate sits off here, and these are little fragments of what was left of the eastern part of the Pacific Plate. Now we call them sort of separately, but if you want to think about them as the eastern part of the Pacific Plate, that's okay. And they are being subducted or overridden by North America, right along here, all the way down to Cape Mendocino in California. And at that point then, it is a strike slip. It's not a subduction, that is not a convergent boundary, but a strike slip boundary where the pieces are sliding past each other. That's the San Andreas Fault Zone. And so the volcanoes are generated when this subducted slab, here's the Juan de Fuca Plate again, here's the Pacific going off toward Japan and Kamchatka and the Aleutians. And this piece then is going down beneath Western North America because it's heavier. And so whenever these two collide, the heavier piece always goes goes down underneath. Now at about 175 kilometers, so about 100 miles below the surface, the minerals in this oceanic plate start to change. They're not stable under that high temperature and pressure. They were stable up here where they were formed, but now they're not stable under this high temperature and pressure, and they start to dewater. It's a dehydration reaction. They start to make forms that are more stable under those high temperatures and pressures. And you can see there are some deep earthquakes here, and we'll come back to that in a little while. But this slides underneath, but it doesn't slide without earthquakes. A stick slip, the motion of those two plates as one rides over the other, causes earthquakes. That's what causes earthquakes, is the rapid slip of one plate along another one.
Why is the plate on the left heavier?
Why is it?
Yeah.
It's the minerals that it's made up of. Has more iron and magnesium. This one has more quartz, which is lighter, and feldspar, another mineral group, which is lighter than all these iron and magnesium minerals. So it is just more dense and heavier, and so when those two come together, that one always loses. This is the bobber and this is the sinker. And then this dewatering reaction, there are a few ways to make rocks melt. You can heat them up. You can release the pressure, that is, cause a fault to release the pressure. That's the Rio Grande Rift or the East Africa Rift. Or you can add water. When you add fluids to these rocks down here, they're already hot enough. They're just under such pressure that they can't melt. But when you add water, then they melt and they come to the surface. And so that is what's generating the cascades here, is this, we call it the Cascadia subduction, right offshore here. And I don't plan to spend a lot more time on this, but if you're interested in this and you didn't see that earlier lecture, well, we could talk about it after.
This crack between the two plates?
Here.
Yeah.
That's the spreading center. And so the oceanic plates are pulling apart, and new, that's one place where you release the pressure and you generate lava, you generate magma. And so it's coming to the surface or it's coming to the surface of that plate.
Right.
It's under sea most of the way. The place where it comes to the surface is Iceland. And so Iceland sits right on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, not on the Pacific side, but on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And I was saying the other night that that's where we go and study what happens lots of times, because you don't need a bath escape or some other submarine, you can walk on it. And it's one of the places where we've actually, with GPS, measured the separation of the plates. And they move about as fast as your thumbnail grows. So you look at your thumbnail, and it's not doing very much today. If you leave it for a month or two, it'll get long. And so this is a slow, by our time standards, fairly slow process, but it goes on for millions of years, and that's the key. So pieces of these pieces of oceanic plates and continental fragments may have moved all the way across the Pacific at the rate that your thumbnail grows. It's just that they have a long time to go, that distance. And so...
Sorry, there has been a discussion in our classroom. So the accretion of the continental plates, they were already above the surface of the ocean, moving across like islands or creating
the
continental like 1,000 miles long, and then they accrete onto the continent.
Here. There's a fragment of a continent that is rifted off, and it's heading for North America. If you had been there, these are mostly Cretaceous and younger. So in the last 60 million years, you wouldn't have to worry about the dinosaurs, but you could see some of these plates coming over the horizon. And
then the pillow lava or other sea floor managed to be not so dense enough that it managed to accrete to the...
Some places like right here, pieces of the seafloor and the sediment on the seafloor get scraped off.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of those pieces... Whoop, going backwards. That's a brief some of these pieces are in fact that off scraping of the downgoing slab.
Chuck,
okay.
Where does you talked about how melting water or melting the rock and how if water's added to it. Well, where does the water come that gets added to it?
It's actually in the oceanic crust. So there is some water in those minerals.
Okay.
And, you know, they're hydrated minerals, and when they get under high temperatures and pressures, they start to rearrange themselves to different minerals that are more stable under that higher temperature and pressure, and the water is left over, it's expelled.
I'm just curious about Iceland. If Iceland is this top of this plate, do the builders and architects have to take that into consideration when they build?
In Iceland?
Us.
Well, I'm sure the earthquakes, because it's seismically quite active, you know, it's on one of those. But actually, the rifts are well-defined. So they don't necessarily build in those rifts. They build them next door to them or near them, but you can't get very far away in Iceland. But the problem there is to build for the earthquakes, which luckily are not too great. The size of the earthquakes is not too great because they happen a lot. There's a lot of them, but they're not too big, so all the time they're shaking. But we'll come back to that in a little while. So these are the volcanoes of the Cascade Range now, and there are older volcanoes down here in California that were part of the Cascade Range, but when this piece right here, when that point right there, it has been moving up the California coast, when it went by a certain volcano inboard like this, that volcano goes out like a light bulb because Strike Slip, that is the San Andreas Fault, doesn't have a subducted slab. And so there's no subducted slab, there's no volcano. So that's why there's not many active volcanoes. Well, there's no active volcanoes related to subduction south of Cape Mendocino. It's because there's no subduction south of Cape Mendocino. Okay, and so there's a series of big stratovolcanoes built on the North American continent related to the subduction along this Cascadia subduction zone, where oceanic crust is going down below North America, dewatering, melting the rock, coming up in a fairly spectacular fashion sometimes. Now, The Cascadia subduction zone, or it's a series of faults, or a fault array of faults, but the Cascadia subduction zone, for those that live along the northwest coast, may be a bigger problem than the volcanoes. Because what we know is that when you go to Oregon and some places in the southern coast of Washington, you walk up the creeks that empty into the ocean, and they have big boulder deposits way up in the creek, like a kilometer or two up in the creek. And you go, well, this creek didn't bring these here. What did? What did are tsunamis. And the tsunamis form when there's a earthquake in the ocean floor that drops or quickly raises the ocean floor. And that displaces the water. Here, the water fills in there, but when it sloshes, it causes the great waves. That's what happened in Indonesia and Thailand a couple of years ago. And so there are deposits along that coast that we now recognize, just in the last 10 years or so, maybe 15, as being tsunami deposits. And also, this is very quiet. There aren't very many earthquakes on the Cascadia subduction zone. So it's just the opposite of Iceland. And so we're becoming aware now that in places where this plate is going under that plate, there's no question about that, the strain is building up and that debt will have to be paid. And it's just like living in San Francisco or somewhere with the San Andreas Fault. When? Well, we don't know. People are working very carefully to try and date those tsunami deposits and date other pieces of evidence left by the big earthquakes, what we think were big earthquakes, on the Cascadia subduction zone right along here. But that is an issue for people living along the western coast. Okay, we might come back to that. It says where the earthquake, you know, how wide the aftershocks might be, because the first motion just sets up strain in the other faults, and so they start to fault as well, and little movements, that's what the aftershocks are. Okay, so we are subducting part of the Pacific plate, the oceanic crust, underneath North America, and it's causing dewatering. This is a little bit overblown here. I don't think that there's that much magma, but nevertheless, it comes to the surface as the volcanoes along, and they're fairly regularly spaced along there, because this is a self organizing system. Okay, so here's a before and an after picture of Mount St. Helens. Taking it from nearly the same spot, you can see the bump here and the bump here. And I tried to get them about the same size. But so you see that piece of Mount St. Helens left in a hurry in 1980. And I told you that I almost missed my older daughter's wedding because I was stuck behind a volcano in London earlier this year. And actually, I hate to say this, but it was in Ogden, Utah, trying to get back to Tucson when Mount St. Helens went off, and it took me an extra day to get there because of the ash cloud. So if there's volcanic activity around, don't fly with me. Okay, so this can happen explosively. What happened at Mount St. Helens was not what they expected and was atypical of these mountains. And that is that what they expected was this summit eruption here, blasting up material, and not very much juvenile material came out of Mount St. Helens. Most of the ash was the top of the mountain that got vaporized and sent off. Only a cubic kilometer or so of new material came out at Mount St. Helens. It was a pressure bomb, not a volcanic eruption. But what happened and what killed all the people including a fellow named Johnson, who was a geologist sitting in a monitoring station several miles from the eruption, was that it came out the side. What happened is the side of the mountain collapsed in a big landslide, and all of that pressure and magma came straight out this way. And everybody in the way, it comes out probably a couple hundred miles an hour, faster than you can run, and about 600 or 700 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than you can breathe. So they didn't really have much of a chance.
Once they saw the bulge, did they know that it would probably come out?
No, even then, they knew it was, the eruption was imminent. And it was bulging at several inches a day, several feet a day at the end. So the side of the mountain was actually expanding. And so they knew the eruption was imminent. They just didn't realize that the magma was close enough to the side of the mountain that it was going to take it out. And there was a, at about 8:27, there was a magnitude 5 earthquake on the mountain. And at about 8:32:11, so we've a few minutes. It took a few minutes for this thing to really get going. They started to have the landslide. So this is the start of the landslide. These are the famous Rosenquist photos. If you haven't ever seen those, they're magnificent. Guy just happened to be standing there with his camera and a tripod, and he got so nervous that the center, it's not centered, it's off to the side, because he turned around and looked back and it bumped the tripod a little bit. But they're still magnificent. And so the landslide started at 8:32:47 at 2.2 seconds, about the time it took me to tell you about it. This landslide then started to evacuate this part, and these parts started to fall in. 3 or 4 seconds later, the first eruptive material started coming out of that hole left by the landslide. And just a minute later, it was in full eruption. And this is the cloud right here that's coming out. It's not in this picture, but coming out that way.
So he made it out safely?
He did not, actually. That's why the volcano observatory at Mount St. Helens is called the Johnson Observatory.
So these were Johnson's pictures?
No, these are a fellow named Rosenquist. Yeah. Rosenquist made it out fine. He was standing over on the next mountain and just sort of waiting, I guess. And just happened to be at the right place at the right time. Or the right place at the wrong time, depending on. Hey, look at that. But these are magnificent photographs of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. And they have been analyzed over and over again. Everybody's that's thinking about volcanoes has taken a look at these, because they are so closely spaced in time that you can actually see how things developed. It would have been nice to have a high definition video, but this is the best we did. Well, of course, the blast was several atomic bombs worth, blew down great areas of the forest, and when you fly over it, or it's starting to get covered now, but the first time I went up there, the blast zone was several miles before you got to the volcano. Before you could even see the volcano, all these trees were lined up and dead, all the bark stripped off them. It's hard to imagine. The ice and snow melted, and there were great mud flows down the Toodle River and the other rivers nearby. They actually had to close the Columbia for a while, just because it silted up. That stuff came down so fast. And of course, everybody in the way was in the way. And so the mud flows created by the volcano caused great devastation. Killed 53 people, I think that one did. Okay, so here's Mount St. Helens. And here is a map, not here, this just, I don't know why they put that there. But in Oklahoma, somebody fell in Oklahoma, but not that much. But here is a contour map of the I don't know, maybe the guy was in Oklahoma, the Jews, but here's the volcano, and here's the sort of ash that came around. Those of you who were here may have experienced some of the ash that came out. It is fine particles of, and very sharp particles, so it's not very good to breathe. It is terrible for the engines, and so we'll get back to that in a little while. But most of it was a little bit south of Holden, but you can see it went all the way over into Spokane, and if you live around there, you remember probably. I was here in Utah, and the plane I was supposed to get on was coming from Seattle, and they told me, not quite, but almost, sorry, Charlie, it's not going to happen today. And so, because of the effect it would have, those fine particles in those turbines. And that's why they were worried in London, when I was there in London, stuck behind the Iceland volcano, was the effect that the turbine, on the turbines, on jet turbines. So here's a time lapse, sort of. Here's Mount St. Helens. And we said it was 833. So by 845, the ash was halfway to Yakima. By about 2 hours, it was in Pasco, and in about 3 hours, it was to Idaho, and then it was to Helena a little later on in the day. And by later on that day, it was all the way down into southern Idaho. So that ash cloud, once it got up, it went 80,000 feet up in the air, so you can imagine the amount of pressure that was on it to shoot it up 80,000 feet into the air. You know, I don't know, maybe they had some sort of thing in Oklahoma. I didn't realize that Oklahoma was impacted that much.
Downdraft.
Or either that, or this guy copied that map, or that guy copied this map. I don't know which, but I don't remember hearing the guys from the University of Oklahoma complaining about that. And there were people flying around the volcano, luckily on the east side, in a small plane that actually gave a commentary. Two geologists were flying around in a small two-seater plane on the east side when the volcano went off, and so they gave a commentary. Okay, here are there is a sort of a geeky classification of the strength of volcanic eruptions, and here you see the Hawaiian are really non-explosive. Why? Because it's a different kind of lava. What happens is you add silica to the lava and it starts to form complexes that interlock and make it much more viscous. So the Hawaiian volcanoes out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean don't have that much silica in them, so they run like water. You've seen pictures probably, National Geographic, of those things. Mount St. Helens here is about 5. So it's about in the middle. We thought it was pretty big because we were that close to it. I was really inconvenienced, so I would put it at 9 or something. I was really upset, because I had stuff to do. But apparently that didn't count. Colossal ones, Krakatoa in 1883, of course, was heard all the way up into Malaysia, the sound of it, and into the Spice Islands in the Philippines. Blew Krakatoa really completely out of the water, blew it up. And then there have been some really super colossal. And then this one is so-called super volcano that you might have seen on TV. The Yellowstone is the site of active volcanism right now. The magma body, we think, is about 3 kilometers below the surface, so about a mile and a half or so. And if you look at the big caldera eruptions, calderas are places where the magma chamber erupts and vacates itself, and then the stuff that was over the top of it, the roof actually collapses into it and forms this depression, this big depression. And Yellowstone National Park is actually a series of what we call nested calderas. But the last big one here, 2 million years ago, but there are younger caldera eruptions there. And I used to lead field trips into Jackson Hole in Yellowstone, and the age sequence goes from about 1.8 million years before present, a big eruption, 1.2 million years before present, there was a big caldera eruption, 600,000 years before present, there was a big eruption. So if you take that series of numbers, 1.8, 1.2, 600,000, what's the next one in that series? Zero. Oh, gee. Well, I don't know. I think on TV they've made it sound like it's next Thursday, but it's not actually going to happen that much and that soon. And it could be big, though. I don't think there's any question about that. We shouldn't assume this is going to be big. But it will give you some notice. When the magma, when that liquid magma or mush moves through the crust, it cracks the rocks, and that's what causes earthquakes. So all of these, Krakatoa, Vesuvius, Mount St. Helens, they all gave plenty of warning that they were going to go. You know, they have earthquakes. Cicero, or Pliny the Elder, for several weeks, had his one of his guys watching the vibrations in his bowl of water, you know, timing the earthquakes and tremors. He didn't know what it was, but he just knew, well, that's not right. And so he had the guy timing him. Pliny the Elder was a good scientist. Not that good. He went down on the beach to see the eruption and didn't come off the beach. But anyway, that's the super volcano that you might have heard of. And it is a big one, not the biggest, huh?
Don't they say that the hot spot under Yellowstone is like slowly moving under thicker crust?
It is. We think it is. Yeah. And the reason is, let's see if I have a slide. Oh yeah, I can show you on this. If you look at the Columbia River basalts, so the basalts that form the Columbia River plains there, they start out up here in Oregon at about 16 million years. And they get progressively younger as you go across southern Idaho, and zero here. So some people think, and I think there's pretty good evidence, that what's happening is there's a hot spot in the mantle, and North America is actually tracking over. And so what you have is like a match, holding a match under a piece of paper. And so if you move that paper across that match, every so often you raise the match, and it burns a hole through the paper. So it's kind of like that. And it is getting younger and younger and younger all the way across the Idaho. Those baked potatoes we had the other night would be baked if Yellowstone went off. Okay. So here are some sizes. I'm not sure what this scale is. Actually, because it's not, here's Mount St. Helens, it is not volume. It is maybe estimated violence of the eruption or something like that. But you can see that Mount Mazama down at Crater Lake was another big one. Huge guy, and ash from Mount Mazama. The Mazama ash is spread over most of western U.S. Here's Mount St. Helens. It's actually kind of piddly when you think about it. We thought it was really big because we were there. But the rest of these, Krakatoa, Tambora is that really big one. And they don't have Yellowstone on here. But Mount Mazama on this bunch is clearly the biggest. It was a whopper. It took away much more of the volcano than did the Crater Lake.
Chuck, what about Pompeii? Where would that fit?
Pompeii?
Yeah, it's Vesuvius.
On this scale, which is volume of erupted lava, it'd be up in here somewhere. There wasn't that much erupted lava or ash, really, in Pompeii. It was mostly the hot... see, what happens is the hot gases explode out of the volcano, and they're hot, so they're buoyant, but they start to cool, and they have a lot of ash in them, and so even though they're 500 or 600 degrees Fahrenheit, that's relatively cool, so they start to collapse, and they collapse down the side of the volcano in what we call a glowing cloud, or the French is nuée ardente, and so that's what got a lot of people in Pompeii. The ash was like 20 feet deep in Pompeii, but it was right on the flanks. I mean, you can see the volcano from where they were sitting. So so that was probably why there was so much there. Here's the Yellowstone we talked about. Long Valley, Caldera, if you're from California, that's over by Bishop. Spread the Bishop Tuff widely over western U.S. Pinatubo. That closed the Army base, or the Air Force base there at Pinatubo, provided so much ash that they just said, you know, it's not worth cleaning it up, shoveling all that stuff off, and we left Pinatubo, that Air Force base.
That's the Philippines?
That's the Philippines, yeah. Mount St. Helens is here. It's about 1 cubic kilometer of juvenile material, new material out. And then Mono Lake, Inyo Craters, those are more recent. They're caused by cracking. So we said release pressure and you cause rocks to melt. And, you know, they're pretty interesting to fly over because they're pretty recent and it's pretty dry over there, so you can see them. So if you fly over Mono Lake, you'll see these magnificent volcanic flows. Okay, here's the ash fall from Mount St. Helens we talked about. Here is Yellowstone, 630,000 years ago. That's the most recent one in that series, 1.8, 1.2, 600. That's where it goes. The Long Valley caldera, I don't know which, I think it's this right here. Yeah, Long Valley ash, yes, sir. It's this right here. And over western U.S., we see that in all of the deposits, and it's actually quite good because it's a timeline. We know 750,000 years ago, that's when that was. And so everything above is younger, everything below is older. And then the 2-million-year-old eruption was all the way out here and around like that. And it was powerful enough, or the winds were such that it actually came west too. So, Mount Baker is almost straight west from here, not quite. But here's what it looks like. It has had some steam eruptions. I can remember being up here in the Pacific Northwest visiting friends when steam was coming off Mount Baker, and people were quite worried. There weren't enough earthquakes to tell you that it was really dangerously close to erupting, but anytime volcanoes start steaming, they kind of get a little twitchy. So there's big eruptions. These are thousands of years. So about 12,000 years ago, Mount Baker erupted. It's had a few more with Lahars. And Lahars, someone told me that the geologist last week was here and was a specialist in Lahars. Lahars are sort of volcanic mud flows, so really hot water and mud come down the side, and in some places they sort of form almost like cement when they cool. They're really, you have to chip them away, kind of, you can't just dig them away. But parts of the mountain have collapsed at various times, just like it did at Mount St. Helens, although it didn't collapse enough to reach the magma. And then down here, these are the steam and heat, 1975. And in earlier when the pioneers maybe were here, there was some small volcanic eruptions on Mount Baker. Here's the problem for the West Slope. Some of you live on the west side. And that is just what we illustrated with Mount St. Helens, that these northern Cascade glacier or volcanoes are highly glaciated. They have big glaciers on them. And that, of course, will melt instantaneously and take the side of the mountain, erode the side of the mountain. So it'll come down, and this is the area thought to, that might be affected by that. It goes north toward Linden and out in here toward Bellingham. That river doesn't go to Bellingham, so Bellingham doesn't have to worry too much about it, but it's going to cause a major silt problem here in the area around Mount Vernon, and I have some friends that live in Anacortes, which I think is about right there. And they will be impacted some way. They I don't think that far away that they need to worry about sort of the blast getting them, but and probably the ash, because the wind blows from the west to the east, the ash will go the other way. But this sort of secondary effect really was a big problem at Mount St. Helens and will be at Mount Baker. Okay, here's Glacier Peak, which Heather reminded me was the closest one to Holden. How far? 35 miles, I think you said, 30, 35 miles, close enough. I'm friends and big volcano. It is, of course, a cone-shaped mountain, just like we would expect. And here are some sort of estimates of where the ash will go and how thick it will be. And here we are at Chelan here, and we're actually north of that, and you see this is 60 inches of ash. 5 feet of ash can be expected if there's a major eruption on Glacier Peak, right here where we're sitting. So, that and it is, people don't really think about it because you can't see it very well. It's kind of tucked away, Mount Hood and Mount Rainier. You know, you can see from the road. Whoa. But here, you can't really see that. But it's one of the sort of most active and biggest explosive eruptions of any of the Washington volcanoes. And I'm sure this was added after 1980, except for Mount St. Helens. In the last 14,000 years, which geologically, that sounds like a long time, but geologically, that's earlier this morning. It's even worse than that since this lecture started. Has erupted a dozen times in the 18th century. The 1700s was the last eruption. How do we know that? Nobody was here. Well, we can see the lava flow, the real fresh lava flow, and we can date it with radiometric isotopes. And in the 1700s, we can date it with tree rings. The stuff that's growing on it and the stuff that was overrun by it. So here's a little timeline. Here's the big eruption and here's some smaller eruptions, but they get pretty close to zero there. Yeah?
For my Forest Service job at Lake Wenatchee Ranger District, we did digs looking for Native American sites, and we would find the different ash layers from Glacier Peaks eruptions, yeah, and the different tools that were left behind, so the archaeologists could date the habitation of the Upper Wenatchee Valley,
sure,
based on Glacier Peaks eruptions.
And we said, I don't know, yesterday or day before, that there are lots of sites that are 12,000 years and younger, mm-hmm, and so. These people weren't crazy, you know. When that thing started rumbling, they sort of left and in a hurry and left their tools behind in Flagstaff in Arizona, northern Arizona. Immediately after the eruption stopped, they came back in because the soil was rich, it held water. They started growing corn and squash, things like that. Yeah.
So So is the 60 inches of ash here, Holden, from, estimated on the smaller eruptions, like the in the 70s?
That's probably a big guy. Large eruptions, right? About 13,000 years ago. So they're basing this on a big eruption of Glacier Peak 13 or 14,000 years ago. So this guy here.
Yeah, so if it's a smaller eruption, like
won't be as big. No, that's right. Won't be as thick here.
The ash layers on the digs were like 6 inches or 2 inches. So the
still, you think of, you saw those pictures of Spokane and those Pocatello. And 6 inches of ash coating everything.
And it wasn't. It was light as dust.
Yeah, that's right. You see the helicopters landing on Mount St. Helens to try and sort out what happened to those people. And it's like this big cloud of dust. You have to wear a respirator and stuff. And you'd at least have to wear a bandana and probably go down to Home Depot and get one of those white things, those white paper things.
Yeah, my wife visited Guatemala several weeks after the eruption down there this summer. And she said they would come in at night and wash their faces and not realize how much ash dust was still in the atmosphere until they washed their faces and looked at the washcloth and it would be covered with black.
Guatemala? Right there on the plate boundary. Mm-hmm. It's actually on the plate, it's right at the corner between this plate boundary and that plate boundary. So Guatemala is especially active. He gets it from a couple of different sides. Okay. This is just a refresh of what we just
But even though Oregon didn't seem to be in the ash fall map.
What's that?
Oregon didn't seem to be, I didn't see Oregon seeming to be under the ash fall map for St. Helens, but it snowed ash in
Oregon too.
But that was, there was different eruptions.
Oh yeah, it went on for, months. Yeah. I mean, but
that's
first
right.
One, the first.
Yeah, there wasn't much here, is there? But you're right.
Later eruptions, the winds were going different.
Probably the guy in Oklahoma here that was drawing the map wasn't. He just didn't live in Portland. He didn't have any relatives in Portland, so. Okay, and here is here's the sort of assumed debris flows and mud flows and things from Glacier Peak. And you see poor old Burlington and Cedar Woolley and Mount Vernon get it again because of the Skagit River. But these guys aren't out of the mud either. And so on the west side, that will probably be the biggest effect, but it will be a real pain on the west side of the divide. The ash, if unless it's really unusual weather conditions, will go toward Holden, and then off toward points east. Now, this is what the inside of these things look like. They are built up by lava flows and ash and cinders in some cases. They usually have a central conduit. What does that say? Center. Yeah, central conduit that comes to the peak and provides a vent at the top. They also have places where the lava intrudes into, and sometimes this is an earlier little volcanic center that gets eroded or covered up by the big guy finally. And then they'll have some magma bodies that intrude sort of sideways or off of this main conduit. I'm sure that was put there after Mount St. Helens, because that's exactly what happened at Mount St. Helens. Actually, this big bulb down here, that big bulb down here, was probably somewhere up in here. And it when the earthquake occurred, the landslide occurred, this stuff came out the center, out the side. And so lots of different kinds of eruptions. Of course, you can have steam. These pyroclastic flows are the nuée ardente, or the glowing clouds. Nobody here would remember Saint-Pierre and Martinique, but that's what got all those people. And lately, where was it? One of those Caribbean islands that are volcanoes. they had to evacuate part of the island because of these pyroclastic clouds. These are 600 or 700 degrees C, and they come rolling down at several hundred miles an hour. So they just vaporize everything really in there. These lava domes are what you see in the core of Mount St. Helens, but they grow on the side. That's a little piece of a little bit of lava that came up on the side. It's not enough to cause a big eruption, but builds a dome here. And then pyroclastic flows, those are the glowing clouds. These plumes come up and they collapse and back down the side. So these are, and then, you know, they generate their own weather. In Mount St. Helens, you might remember seeing scenes of lightning and things like that. But this gas can be quite toxic, and so sometimes it forms acid rain. Sometimes the lava flows come right off the top and down the sides. Other times they'll break out of the sides and just start flowing off in this direction. The problem is that this conduit right here gets plugged, and the pressure continues to build. And again, that's a debt that will have to be paid. And so at Mount St. Helens and Mount Mazama, Crater Lake, all of a sudden, Krakatoa, all of a sudden, the pressure overcomes the overburden weight. It just sends it off.
Chuck, after Mount St. Helens happened, what have we learned about predicting in a mountain that we know is going to go soon? Whether we're going to be at the top, whether we're going to be to one side, have we
gained
any knowledge on that?
Yeah, I don't. Since Mount St. Helens was so unusual, I'm sure they'd say, well, the earthquakes were over there, we should have known, you know, that it was coming out the side. And it was expanding, you know, these 1 meter a day at the end. You knew that couldn't last. And so, but I think, you know, what's happened, of course, and the USGS was just about to get rid of its volcano observatory. You know, they have a group over in Hawaii on the volcano but of course cost cutting and, you know, everything. They just want to cut costs, and so we didn't really need these guys. Boom, and now, you know, it's back active, quite active again. But I think it is a time bomb. I mean, it's going to go off. These are active volcanoes, and we live in the middle of them. Our lifespan, our time frame, is much shorter than the eruptive cycles. So it's not going to go off next Thursday. Watch now. Okay. Not going to go off next Thursday. If it does, call me. I'll be in Denver or somewhere.
What about Mount Rainier?
Yeah.
Same story. Same tune, next verse.
There's some steam coming there all the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
But for you students, if you lived in our town near Mount Rainier, you would have but every year there's a number of drills. And what students will have to do in our town, if it does erupt, is they will have to walk to the high ground so the Lahars can not hurt them.
But
and they train for that.
I think the danger of that, of having to use that information, that drill, is really small. Because we're going to know for months. We knew for months before Mount St. Helens went off that it was going to erupt. Pinatubo, same. They probably knew, if they knew what to look for, at Krakatoa. They certainly did at Vesuvius. So these mountains are so well instrumented now that if there's a hiccup, if a frog hiccups on Mount Baker, they know about it. And not quite. I mean, I hate to say that for impressions we don't mind. Because it isn't quite like that. But they do watch these things very carefully. And there are a certain type of rhythmic earthquakes when fluid moves through the rock. And so, now, if you live in Yakima or Pocatello, they're not going to evacuate. But you better go down and get some masks. But if the earthquakes pick up and are of certain kind at Glacier Peak, we're not going to be in Holden, and they're not going to be in Chelan, and they're not going to be in Wenatchee. They'll pull everybody out of there. And they would have done that at, and the people who were killed at Mount St. Helens were outside of the red zone. So there was no thought. If that would have gone up instead of outward, those people would all have, there would have been not so much fun driving around in that stuff, but they would have been fine. Yeah.
Except for people like Harry Truman who lived at...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they chose not to evacuate the red zone. Forest fires, same thing.
Yeah.
People
hurricanes.
Decide not to go. Hurricanes.
Yeah, I'll write it down.
Yeah. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Tom, at Pinatubo, the commandant of the Air Force, the Clark Air Force Base was not going to leave until they saw the geologists actually leave. Maybe the Air Force Service.
Yeah, that's right. And I think Pinatubo caught them a little bit by surprise, not the eruption. They knew it was going to erupt.
But the landslides.
But the amount of ash that covered up Clark. And I say, it buried the buildings, and the Air Force decided, well, they were already having trouble with the locals about being there. And so the Air Force just said, it's not worth doing this. And that's kind of what happened actually at Pompeii and Herculean, that there was no good reason to go back in and excavate it. And then stuff grew on top of it, and they forgot it until 1800s. So late 17th. Okay, so here are the peaks. And these same little funny diagrams with the little volcanoes on them. What you notice is some are quite active, and some are not so active. Is that good news or bad news? I don't know if we actually know the answer to that yet. It could be good news in that the magma is not building up under there. I don't think that's an assumption we would all like to make. I think we should assume that is sort of building up and will eventually erupt. The Jeffersons, the Three Sisters, haven't erupted for a long time, and so on and so on. Of course, Crater Lake hasn't erupted because it's still building up. It's replenishing the magma chamber from the last time it erupted, which was catastrophic. Lassen may erupt again. It is, there's always steam and a little bit of stuff coming out of Lassen, and that produced ash. Shasta, you see, is quite active. So the story is that it's an ongoing geologic process. We just live in the middle of it. Yeah.
Have there been any, the incidences seem to be dependent upon the rate of tectonic pull, the lateral movement of these plates. Have there been any measurements to determine whether or not that rate is slowed or increased over the past?
Well, it is not directly related. It's not a one-to-one correlation between the rate of subduction and the rate of volcanism. It's much more complicated than that. But we think that the cascade subduction zone is relatively slow. Why? Well, what's causing that to continue is that this is heavy. This piece that's going down is heavy. And so it's actually pulling that down. But there isn't much out here to pull. So it's actually kind of slowed down. This is a fairly, the cascade subduction zone is relatively slow compared to the Indonesian, places like that, the Banda Arc. So, but it isn't. There's other things involved. The minerals that are in that plate that go down, how hot the steamosphere is when the stuff that's below the continental crust and mantle. So what minerals are in there, things like that, are all factors in the volcanic activity. And you look at this, and it's, well, some of them are really hot and going off quite often, and others don't. But the long-term average is probably roughly the same. There are there are some places like Mount St. Helens that are anomalous because they are quite active compared to the rest. But every one of these big volcanoes got there fairly recently, in the last 400,000 or 500,000 years. And so that activity is still ongoing in every one of them. They're all active. So it's not, there aren't any dormant volcanoes or dead volcanoes in this cascade system.